Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Robots and Red Tape. As always, I'm your host, Nick Schutt. Happy to have Chris Teixeira here with me today. Chris, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, enjoying the nice weather the spring brings us.
Absolutely, man. It is just gorgeous outside today. And yeah, man, I appreciate you hanging out inside for us when I know we'd much rather be outside doing some stuff. So hey, appreciate that, man. If you don't mind, Chris, for everybody that doesn't have the opportunity to know you yet, do you mind just telling folks a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of, what you're doing, and man, what's your story? How'd you get here?
Sure. So I'm Chris Fixer. I'm a principal data scientist at MITRE, a not-for-profit technology company that operates R&D centers for the federal government and collaborates with industry and academia to enhance the safety and stability of our nation and the world. During my career, I've had the pleasure of supporting a number of government agencies, always from the perspective of trying to find that right approach to supporting decisions with the right data at the right time. It's always been a bit of a challenge with regards to, making sure you have that right data, or even being able to, articulate that right problem set, but being able to, work through figuring out what that means, being able to tackle some of those, the country's toughest challenges, and really just getting to work with some cool math along the way. My academic background is in mathematics and operations research. So these days I tackle anything from kind of data engineering challenges to, different modeling types to try to understand uncertainty as it presents itself in the world, to how do you communicate this to the people that need to know, whether it be other federal agencies or the public at large.
That's fantastic,
It's been
man.
a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I love MITRE. I love what you guys do. I love your organization's mission. And anytime we're talking about research and R&D and finding ways to push the, technology boundaries forward, I'm super interested and I'm engaged already, right? And so what are some of the things you've tackled for MITRE, and what are you working on now?
So I've had the pleasure of working across multiple of our FFRDCs, or federally funded research and development centers, working mostly on the public health side of the world. So working with agencies like the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, along with the Administration for Children and Families, to help them understand kind of what are some of the biggest challenges with data, trying to understand what some of those challenges might bring or influence in terms of their problem spaces that they're looking at, and really help them kind of drive impact to the world, right? Trying to improve kind of, I'll say, the overall health of the country.
Absolutely. That's a huge mission, huge mission. And as you look at, a lot of these different problems and problem sets out there, how does the underlying data, influence your ability to, come up with meaningful solutions? And how do you define data quality as you look at these, these data sets overall?
So data ends up being the key to everything, right? So it's a matter of trying to figure out, well, what is the problem they're looking at, and trying to figure out, well, what data do you have that kind of relates to that problem? So being able to take a step back and say, okay, you have access to the data sets that you procure or collect or have access to in general. And then there's all these other publicly available data sets, but they're all kind of disjoint. They're not necessarily meant or were intended to be combined with each other, or maybe even just trying to understand what is in them, what is inherently comprised in those data streams. From there, one of the things that has been kind of a core component of my career has been looking at the aspect of kind of data quality and what that can mean for these different data streams. So, for example, it's not necessarily just being able to take every single data source, throw it into a machine learning model, and kind of seeing what comes out. It's being able to understand kind of what are some of those biases that might occur, what are some of the inconsistencies in the data, what are some of the maybe the incompleteness, and knowing that maybe even in the terms of incompleteness, it's not a bad thing, but just that you understand what it is, what it represents, and how you might be able to take advantage of data with respect to, the quality you get for it.
Absolutely. And obviously in today's day and age, and it's for everybody that doesn't know, with data being everything, and the quality of data that you have underlying all of it is gonna it you know garbage in, garbage out. The quality of data will directly lead to variation in the quality of end work products, right? And so what are some of the common challenges that you see overall within these spaces, within public health and in the federal sector overall?
Well, I mentioned a couple of them, right? With kind of the idea of incompleteness, but it can, in my experience, it can extend a bit further than that, right? Into even just the timeliness of data. Sometimes, the ability to collect rich data sources is a timely and expensive activity. And so you may get an annual snapshot of something that is great data, but now it's, already 12 months old. Or by the time it's, considered ready to use, it's now maybe 18 months old. When you look at even other rich data sources like the census, you can have estimates that fill in that gap every 10 years, but ultimately it's an estimate. And so even when you have good quality data, you can start to interpolate kind of what that might mean in between when it was collected and what it might mean today. But it provides an additional level of, uncertainty to whatever it is you might be trying to model. And so trying to make sure you incorporate kind of the challenges with incompleteness, the potential biases in how the data might be collected, or being able to correctly represent the system or the problem space that you're trying to model, can provide a lot of challenges with, the data that you might have available to work with. No data set is ever considered perfect for being able to answer the problem you're looking at. So it's all about making sure there's some transparency in what is collected and how it's used.
Yeah, just and I care just is like 12 month trailing standard for like data collection and data sets, or I know you said 12 to 18 months. Was that arbitrary, or is that like based in reality?
It all varies, is what I would say, right? For some problem spaces, it is the standard, right? Being able to, have an annual data collection from grantees, for example, that provide kind of insight into different national, grant programs, is about an annual life cycle for data. However, looking at other data streams come in more live, right? Take health insurance claims for CMS, that is on a continuous data collection aspect. So it just varies. But even things like claims where it is continuously coming in, there are adjustments to data. And so, how do you deal with the fact that, okay, I know you went to a doctor visit, but we may be negotiating how much, insurance pays for versus how much the provider charges, et cetera, can vary quite a bit and ultimately drive a little bit more uncertainty and how accurate is that data source exactly?
Yeah, no, and now I assume some, like, obviously problem by problem, sometimes I would assume you're going to, as you mentioned, combining multiple data sets that weren't necessarily supposed to be combined, or had no idea that this was how they were going to be used upon collection. Do you also use like I assume you had used ancillary data sets that aren't like specific to this problem that have like data that you can use and can scrape from as well, correct?
Yeah, so I mentioned census data as an example, right? For me, it's being able to provide some of that context behind a situation. So you may have a good data stream of, say, all adverse events for children, and that is a well-documented data source that you might be able to work with. However, it doesn't necessarily provide you information about the context of, say, all children to be able to give you kind of that larger world perspective of, how big a challenge might be, how big a problem, something might be, or how, likely an event is to take place exactly.
Absolutely. And I appreciate that, Chris. And I know we've spoken about this before, is that when you have, you set up a model, and there's constant data coming in. So it's not one of these annual like grant reporting ones, right? You build a great model, but you have data streaming in, say, relating to children, children and maybe you're pulling that data from CMS or some other places. But how can data input into a model over time, have unintended consequences?
Sure. Well, let's take a step back and talk about what unintended consequences really means here, because I do think this is it's a nuance that not everyone necessarily thinks about all the time. Because with machine learning, you're often modeling a particular decision space, right? Being able to take a bunch of data in, you are trying to describe a behavior of how an entity or a person or a business might be operating with the idea of being able to predict that outcome or a particular set of outcomes and the likelihood of those outcomes. However, we always, as a data scientist, we aim for being in building accurate models. I can make in a model that, say, is 90% accurate, and that's great according to most standards. However, when we talk about unintended consequences, we're not thinking about, well, what happens after that decision is made? What is that kind of second order effect or maybe third order effect that starts to impact, the environment in which those decisions are operating? So when it comes to kind of data quality and starting to impact some of those unintended consequences, it gets really tricky fast. Ultimately, I look at the aspect of kind of a system that, it's near and dear to my heart around child welfare and the aspect of, looking at abuse and neglect reporting. So it is a stressful situation where a lot of children, or a lot of reports come in about children being potentially abused or neglected. The adult usually is trying to kind of represent what is going on. What did they witness? What did they see? What do they suspect? Being able to collect that data is not necessarily from an expert, and so and is often happening very quickly. And so a lot of data collection, it may be incomplete or inaccurate in its data collection. And ultimately, looking at, how much of that information they can really trust going forward into making really what is a very critical decision. If you're looking at kind of modeling important decisions like that, you end up focusing in on, well, we need to optimize, if you want to kind of take a data science term, we want to optimize child wellness. And so the idea of being able to say, well, we want all children to be safe. I think you and I are both parents. We can certainly appreciate that. However, if you just start saying, well, we need to protect all the children all the time, that can quickly start to overwhelm a welfare system. And
Absolutely.
in potentially being able to just take all the children away from their parents or trying to just overemphasize that kind of decision either overwhelms the system. Or you start looking at the second and third order effects of what happens when you remove a child from their family, it perhaps incorrectly. Those are the challenges that are really hard to predict and really hard to kind of focus on or be able to understand kind of that potential when, a decision you have for a child today, you may not see that kind of impact or the result of that for years to come.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when you think about, children and child welfare specifically, that's a very high stakes decision for the child's life, for the family's life. And I would assume that there's a lot of children out there that unfortunately for them should not be in this situation they're in at home, right? From like their family is not stable, but then where do you take them? How does that affect them? How do you weigh that for, the removing them from the home versus keeping them in the home and look at that from a, what's better for the child in the long term? And I would assume that's also a case by case basis. It's very subjective. And to your point, a lot of the folks that are out here doing the front end data collection, right? These are folks that work for, they work for local family, local like child welfare societies at like either local government or state government largely. They're under-resourced and too busy. And social workers in general, social workers, counselors, folks that do this are amazing and they do amazing work, but they're certainly, I would assume, not writing reports, assuming that it's going to get pulled into another data model as well, and then used to model and predict and guess help build what that actually looks like, right? And also, what percentage of children left in a home in an unstable situation is acceptable? How do you allocate those resources, right? It becomes very, very, very complicated, very, very fast, right?
Well, and just to emphasize the point, the negative outcome here of a child dying is the worst outcome you can think of? And how risk adverse do you want to be in trying to understand, where is that threshold for, trying to balance those resources, right? It's not, I don't think it's an easy decision at all. It often requires bringing in a lot of experts to be able to understand different perspectives on this problem space, making sure that, you understand kind of what are some of those unintended consequences, right? Being able to describe, hey, we may not ever discover everything, if you will, but let's understand what that consequence space looks like. If we get things right, we know what that looks like. We get things wrong, well, what could that look like as well? And it's really that aspect of, if no model is perfect, what happens when you accidentally make a wrong prediction?
And so can you give us an example of what happens when folks have made wrong predictions, and the consequences associated with that?
Yeah, kind of sticking with the child welfare kind of domain, if you will. There was a story a few years ago now around a statistical model being used in this instance for being able to use data that's being collected to try to inform this decision behind should we have police go visit the child in their environment to see what's going on? Can this wait till maybe a week from now? Or can this wait, or, really things are probably fine and we can just kind of check in with them as our, resources light up. Honestly, it's a great idea for a technology in some ways because it's a lot of information. You or I processing that information may make a rush decision because we can only have the capacity for so much information at one time. You and I, being the same person trained the same way, may not even make the same decision necessarily. And so it ends up being kind of somewhat subjective in that we may just interpret things slightly differently. However, so applying a kind of machine learning model to this makes some sense in being able to try to tease out some of that noise and try to be able to kind of provide that objective view into making a decision. The challenge ends up being is if you have a system that's changing, if you have poor quality data or biased data that's feeding into the system, well, you start making kind of the model starts producing poor decisions itself or support of those decisions. And so, and the idea of garbage in, garbage out, when it comes to critical decisions like this, your decision may say, hey, look, this child is fine. We don't need to go there. However, going back a few years, there was a state child welfare agency that used this model without really putting the appropriate checks and balances in front, according to the news article I read. And that resulted in not intervening in about five children's lives, where ultimately they were killed within 6 months later. And so it's a horrible story. It emphasizes the point for behind the use of machine learning models in these kind of critical decision spaces and being able to understand kind of what that accountability might provide.
No, and that's horrible when you see the model supported decisions that were that directly led to the death of children is just heartbreaking. How could in cases like that, let's hope there's less of them, but how can you think that like people over or institutions tend to overtrust these models once they're set up and lead to things like this?
It's a good question, Nick, right? Because I think overtrust is something that happens over time. I don't think if necessarily you or I come into play with, an AI system or model that we necessarily just automatically start trusting everything because we learn to think critically about anything that comes our way. However, if a model does good initially because it was just trained on last month's data and is producing good results that are consistent with the decisions that are being made, you can build up trust in a system and it can become, I'm not sure if you want to call it overtrust or become reliant on, that kind of stream of information coming in from the machine learning model to help influence your decision, or it starts to provide more weight behind your decision more and more over time. And, realistically, we're human beings. It's easy to get overwhelmed. It's easy to have a bad night's sleep last night to just start to put that reliance on that information stream and say, well, it hasn't, hasn't burned me in the past. Why don't I just use it? So it's kind of easy from that perspective to kind of build up trust in a system over time without consistently applying that kind of critical perspective of any model.
Absolutely. Me not speaking to this case specifically, but what are some best practices for organizations as say you set the model up, you have some initial success. What are best practices for organizations to make sure that, data quality coming in doesn't reduce accuracy? What should, if you're a leader in either like an agency or a business, like what are just the what would you be doing, and how often would you be like, how would you go about making sure that things maintain that, an acceptable level of accuracy?
I mean, it's definitely tricky and not an easy problem, but there are, I think, some well-known recommendations out there that I would put in place if I were running a business that revolves around the idea of tracking kind of that data stream and all your input data. How is it being used? How is the accuracy of it? Is it changing in values over time? Are there environmental like levers that are being applied to your data streams that might inherently change, the data collection or the way it's being collected or, the values you might be getting? Separately, it's about being able to stay engaged with, I would say, stakeholders, those, folks that are, maybe purchasing, or utilizing the model that I'm building. Maybe it's the result of the people who are being impacted by the model and the decisions that it's starting to influence. But being able to have kind of a review board that checks in regularly, and hopefully does not become a, check the box activity, but really it does come down to having kind of real humans, I would say, not necessarily data scientists, but have, people be able to understand, is the model still as accurate as we want, within kind of certain thresholds? Is it robust enough to kind of continue to behave bef between now and say the next check-in we have? And I always use the framing of, if I were called to court to have to defend this, is it explainable? Can I explain to someone in, maybe human terms, what is the model actually doing? What data is it relying on? How is it influencing the decision space? And not necessarily just explain what's going on in the model, because with some technologies, it's a little difficult to get into the weeds. But being able to at least understand what data is going in, what its intended use is, and then explaining how it gets used on the back end.
Absolutely. No, I appreciate that, because when you think about these things, I agree that having folks like being able to explain to people that are not data scientists, and don't have all of that base understanding, super helpful, right? Because and ideally community stakeholders. So like I one of my businesses I run as a community mental health center, and I have a couple offices in Maryland, and we have quarterly stakeholder meetings where myself, our clinical director and director of ops, and a few other people meet with people in the community to have conversations about how we're doing, how we're doing, how can we do better, what you let us see, and go out of our way to really engage with the community that we are serving, because and get their ideas and thoughts and feedback from a non-practitioner point of view. Many of the, some of the folks are local leaders involved in churches, and others like local business owners, one's from a homeless shelter. And so looking at how are we actually meeting the community's needs is super important for us to make sure that we have a baseline on how are we doing versus last quarter versus the quarter before. And as you start going year over year, you can see organizationally how we're able to address a lot of the community's concerns and ideas. And so I would imagine having something similar for, again, sticking with the child welfare example, having folks that are engaged, stakeholders from the community come in and not do a technical review, but review, the results and the recommendations coming out of these systems might actually be helpful for some of these, again, case by case, but I'm just thinking about it from my point of view, right?
Certainly. And you kind of mentioned a key perspective here, which is the idea of, in your example, you're reaching out kind of to the community that you support. What gets really challenging is when you start to look at national applications, because we do have a variety of populations and cultures across the United States where if you have a particular application, like, say, child welfare, while it's handled down within each state can often be pretty diverse in its population. And so how do you How do you make sure you get those inputs, right? It's a challenging project in terms of being able to get the reach, getting the input, making sure it's timely so that you can then continue on that kind of development path. As a developer who sat back and written enough code in the day, waiting to hear, hey, what's going on, is not always easy. And so you want to make sure that, I think at the end of the day, that it almost ends up being continuous, right? Because you're going to continue learning things. There's going to be continual environmental factors that change. And, in
Well,
addition to, correcting some of the biases or things that you may have understood previously, but are changing and need to be adapted for tomorrow's problems.
Absolutely, absolutely, and predicting the, predicting, I think, like predicting the future, which or predicting is, is at times easier than others. I just think about a lot of the work that was done in, say, 2019, predicting what was going to happen in 2020, like. We were all wrong, at least I hope. But we were we were all wrong. Like nobody really saw the global pandemic coming, at least not in January of 2019. I certainly didn't. I'm not sure if you through your work at the CDC had heard anything, but or if that's who you were working with at the time. But as you look at like it is absolutely a it's a it's a prediction. There's going to be room for error. There's going to be margin, especially as you look at, trying to, like, in your case, predicting health trends, right?
Well, and I think one of the most important jobs of kind of any data scientist out there isn't how well you can write code necessarily. It isn't even necessarily understanding all the data that might be feeding into your model, because you have experts that you can rely on to help you understand how the data was collected and, what might be the best ways to process or use it for your kind of modeling exercise. But really being able to explain some of that uncertainty, right? I've said this a couple of times, but I want to emphasize, like, no model is perfect. And so being able to understand, we're going to get some things wrong, we're going to get some things right, but it's really understanding kind of even the trust in that information that's coming out of it. I may be really good at, say, just picking on the child welfare screening tool, for example. I may be really good some days, and at other times people call in, I may, the model may say, I have no idea. And so, at that, in those instances, those are, opportunities to not just flash up a yes or no. It's an opportunity to stand back and say, okay, well, no, go collect more data, or maybe take another action that is not necessarily standard according to what the model is built for, but builds in some of that inherent trust in being able to try to get to the right answer, even if the model itself isn't going to produce what it thinks is the right answer.
Absolutely, because there's, I mean, there's a big difference between like being technically right and being contextually responsible, correct?
Correct.
And how does that, like, how does that play? Is that largely just human judgment that comes into in where it's like this may be right, but it may not be right in this specific instance, or?
Yeah, it certainly gets tricky, right? And I think at the end of the day, you need to be able to just understand kind of what the impact of your decisions are, right? Being able to take a step back and say, okay, I have what ultimately is a stream of information from my kind of machine learning model. It shouldn't ever be the only decision that's being made, right? Or the only piece of information that's feeding into your decision. It's really being able to take a step back and say, okay, well, I know this, but I also know these other things that are going on too. And let me maybe take a step back and compare, how was I doing previously compared to how I'm doing today? Is there something where, I might call up my best friend Nick and say, hey, Nick, what do you think about this? And being able to get kind of multiple pieces of input to make sure you understand kind of the context for which it's surviving. I think, one of the things that becomes challenging is being able to try to validate the results of decisions. None of us necessarily know what the future may hold. So you might take a validation approach of being able to take your data sources, you know what some of the decisions were made, and so you can kind of validate according to that. But that continuous learning, that continuous validation is another kind of key aspect to I'd say any data science model that's in a production mode like that, to be able to understand, Is context changing? Is your model staying up to date? Is there something that maybe can help the decision makers understand what might be changing in their system better so that they can start to influence maybe new data stream collections or getting rid of some data if perhaps, it's not really actually needed to influence their model.
And I also think that, I think you touched on that if, you can't make a, like, there is no double blind decision on an individual basis where you can say this didn't, like, this child would have been better if we left them, and let's leave one here, and and we'll take one and try it else here, right? Unless you're separating twins. And, like, something that I think, and this is not a one-for-one comparison, but something I always like to think about is, the government bailouts that happened 15 years ago on the first Obama administration. Everybody always talks about how it would have been so much worse if the government didn't bail out, all these industries. But we have no, like, we can guess and we can make predictions as, what it would look like. But again, then there are all of those second order and third order things that, dominoes that would have fallen that didn't fall. And we have no, like, we can say, yeah, it would have been, but, like, we have no real way to functionally measure that in any real accurate way.
No, you're right. It's trying to go back and trying to assess the what if scenario, if you will, behind, what if we chose not to do this or what if we chose to do this? Everyone likes to speculate and everyone likes to, build a model that maybe can get you the answer you want to hear. But it ultimately is being able to make sure you take a step back and say, no, here's our potential space. One of the kind of more fascinating applications of AI these days is being able to explore larger decision spaces or system spaces, right? Like, what is the rules that I'm working within? And setting an AI free to go explore that space and figure it out. However, it's impossible to capture the full system or the complexity of kind of the real world, if you will, for which some of these decisions are being made, right? Child welfare. They have a well-defined system where it's, hey, we need to capture these, and I'm making up a number, 15 different data elements to be able to base our decision on. Well, we can feed 15 data elements into a machine learning model and replicate that decision. However, there's always additional information that's not necessarily captured, that isn't necessarily making its way into that machine learning model. Things like tone of voice. Or maybe things like trustworthiness of this person or their background or their ability to adequately describe things. You just assume all data you collect is truth. And that's not necessarily something that I feel as though you should rely on these days, right? So.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I completely agree. And I also think that for how far AI systems have come over the last, call it 10 years, right? And it's been it incredible, incredible progress. AI systems, all of it, we couldn't. Like, it was early, early days of, I think, was it is this person real.com, where you can go on and you can, like, or this person is not real.com. You go on and you can click a button and it'll just generate new faces over and over and over again. And they going from that to being able to, write full, papers or generate full videos that are actually accurate. And when you look at progression of video development from 2 years ago to now, it's incredible. But for all of that, I believe AI systems are still fundamentally not intelligent. They don't have, they will do exactly what you tell them to do, to the best of their ability, but that doesn't mean that they're using any analytical thinking truly in that process. And, I think that one of the, whenever I'm you working with, whatever, call it Claude, call it ChatGPT, Gemini, whatever. Like, I am never asking it to, I will never ask it to generate lar anything large for me, right? I keep the answers very short and concise, because I think that, as you start thinking about, it'll make one error, and then there'll be compounding errors that will come along that will just, it will deteriorate the quality of your response much, much faster than if, you work with it in short interval, so it has less margin for there to be compounding errors.
No, it's you bring up a number of good points that maybe someday we get to intelligent AI, right? And I'm not necessarily going to say never, but today we're certainly not there. And certainly, there's a lot of varying models that present a number of challenges with being able to just build up that trust in what it's producing, right? One thing I try to emphasize with anyone I work with is the ability to critically think. I want you to th you challenge what any model gives you out, understand what's going on inside of it or how it's going to be used, or even the developer's perspective on how they're building it, because even then they have their own biases that they might be introducing unknowingly. And at the end of the day, it's being able to think about, well, what is it you're producing? How's it going to be used? And, understanding kind of that trade-off between the criticality of getting something wrong. The other example I always love to give is, do you ever work in marketing? The idea is, there's a lot of machine learning that's been going on for decades in that industry for, something as simply saying as who's, which ad should I send this person today? And if you get that wrong, I don't know, I can't speak for you, Nick, in particular, but if you're like me, it just goes to my spam folder. And I never see it. And it costs them a few cents or whatever it might be for being able to send an email or a piece of mail. So at the end of the day, it's all about that consequence and making sure you apply the right critical thinking behind it to understand how and when to use kind of the machine learning model results itself.
Absolutely. And I've spent a couple years working, like teaching myself digital marketing because I'm a lot of reasons, right? But one of the things I always like about I say like I love it because it's so consistent among like marketing consultants and high-end people that do marketing is that they'll talk about all these amazing ideas and they're going to do this and that. And it's just like, yeah, but at the end of the day, we have no idea how the market's going to respond. Like, we just don't know. And so let's go try. It's just trial and error, literally. And maybe they have more experience with trials and errors than I do, but that doesn't mean that, it's just, I just find it fascinating how for all the data we have on marketing, all the data we have on people, you have no idea how it's going to be received. No idea what's going to work. No idea if it's cat like you just if it's sticky, nothing unless you put it out in the market and you find out.
Well, and that gets behind kind of some of the data streams you start to collect, right? When you're trying to think, you take a step back and you write a lot of code to represent the problem space you're trying to model. You're never going to have everything, right? And so at best, your machine learning model is going to produce something where it might be confident in what it's producing, yet it's not necessarily something that is, in the grand scheme of the world, accurate. And so how do you look at terms of accuracy, both at kind of the machine learning definition of accuracy, which, any data scientist can talk to you about, or you take it to your stakeholders and you talk about kind of accuracy for them. And what does that mean when, if you presented them with a decision space, how would they look at it? And for some of these really nebulous kind of challenges with incomplete data or, stressful situations, like take any EMT out there who's, living in stressful situations all day long, they have to make a decision and they may not make it the same decision every time. Those ultimately are challenges that I think, it makes it impossible for a data scientist to model something perfectly. So, yeah, it's just trick. It just ends up being a very tricky situation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And so yeah, as you think about these systems, right? Yeah, at a real high level, yeah, how do you broach the conversation with senior leaders in either in the public sector to explain to them why they need to continue to monitor and maintain their models. Because you spend all the money, you get them, because it's not inexpensive to build a model and model out a specific decision. And how do you explain to them, this problem that we're discussing?
Yeah, and I'll add in there's continued expenses keeping a data scientist on staff to keep an eye on things. At the end of the day, I try to take a step back and think about what is the model supposed to be doing? What decisions is it influencing? What are those consequences? I mean, going back to the child welfare example, we talk about resources are tight. If a model like this can help, free up some of those resources, whether it be in people or time or just money spent, you have to argue those are really great things. However, what are the consequences of having something go poorly, right? And the horrible example I provided earlier, thinking about children who are killed because a model got something wrong is, in my opinion, the worst of the worst in terms of consequences that could happen. So how can you ever fully prevent those consequences? Perhaps not, but you can certainly reduce the risk of those consequences happening by having kind of ongoing or continuous, evaluation of your machine learning model and, being okay with pulling the plug if for some reason you're unable to fix, potential issues that arise with, say, a data stream or just general performance of the model itself.
Absolutely. No, I appreciate that. And how should we handle the gray area between correlation and causation? Because I think that when you look at AI, I think we're in like the dot-com era of AI now. We're early, but I think that I believe over the next couple of years, it's really gonna the amount that it drives decision making and policy making in the public sector, I think will increase. And so how do you and obviously, Chris, being a data guy, you and I both know that how you interpret and present the data can change the can change the conclusions that you draw from it drastically. How do you how would you like how do you even begin to approach that?
Yeah, I'll admit you mentioned the two key phrases of correlation and causation that always make me think of that great XKCD comic strip. But the ultimately, I try to take a step back and think about, it's really being able to understand uncertainty. And from my perspective, you can draw spurious correlations between any two kind of common things. In fact, it's a great website out there if you've ever visited it, spuriouscorrelations.com. And it goes to show you that you can kind of present data in any sort of way you'd like. And at the end of the day, you can influence data. You can lie with statistics, I think is the famous phrase. However, it's about being able to understand what the uncertainty is in not just the data coming in, but the model itself. Where does it do well in terms of maybe looking at it by different populations or different geographies? Maybe it's better over time, as in, perhaps it's doing better in springtime, it's doing horrible in wintertime, whatever it might be. It's being able to understand kind of some of that performance of the model itself. And then looking at kind of things like sensitivity analyses of your model, right? Push it to the extreme, understand how it behaves in those extreme circumstances to see what influence that kind of data might have over producing results for your model, right? Is it going to completely break? Well, that tends to be easier than when it actually works or thinks it's working. And that's what gets hard. I go back to the critically thinking aspect of these things. It's also being able to just continuously asking good questions of the model, right? So thinking about, hey, this is what the model's telling me, but if I make this decision, what happens next? Well, those are two different questions, two different problems. You can't just necessarily assume that something's going to happen just because a model or your decision says to do something. So for me, it's being able to disentangle kind of the questions that you're being able to ask, recognize that sometimes you just need more than one model to be able to fully answer or to pull that thread and trying to understand kind of what some of those answers might start to look like or the what they may cause to happen in your environment down the line.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, we've touched on, some of the known unknowns here. And then you start talking about second and third order dominoes falling after decisions. There's also, there's I don't know if it's the fourth order or whatever, but it's, the unknown unknowns. It's the area where it's the things that come out of left field that happen as a result of a decision you make, and you had no idea how it was going to interact in the marketplace or how it was going to be received in the public. I think thinking about like what happened, what Facebook's accused of doing in Myanmar in 2017-ish is probably one of those areas where it was on like they just I hope they didn't know. But how do you sitting in your position, having built these and building these for a living, how do you kind of figure out what the potential, how do you figure out what the unknown unknowns are before they start causing serious damage or damage in general?
Try to go back to kind of the idea of the review board, if you will, right? And it's not necessarily a review board in terms of just reviewing code. It's really being able to review kind of the decision space that this is influencing. So being able to understand, well, let me take a step back. If you're trying to influence a specific decision, understand kind of what is the impact of that decision, who are the, what are the people, companies, policies that that decision might be impacting. But also being able to take a step back and say, you know, to work with other folks to basically say, well, what would happen if I said this to you, or if I did this thing, how would you look at it? The federal government has a great like capability of producing RFIs to try to gather those unknown unknowns, because as smart as the folks who work for the federal government are, we're all biased by what our backgrounds tell us, right? And what we've experienced. And so you want to get to all those folks who have different backgrounds, get that diversity of thought, trying to influence what it is that you may not be thinking of, and not necessarily just what is it that the model is doing or how to interpret kind of the model itself, but it's really understanding kind of the consequences. I break those consequences down into, well, what happens if I get things right? Well, everyone celebrates or throws a party. If I get things wrong, well, sometimes I get things, you can get things wrong in kind of two flavors. I would think, you know, the idea of false positive and false negatives. If I think I'm going to get something wrong and it should have been true, well, that's not good. But it may have less consequence than saying getting something wrong and thinking it was, in fact, an incorrect decision. You know, going back to the child welfare case, you can break those down into examples like I chose to intervene too early and I separated a child from his family. I don't think anyone think, you know, that could be the wrong decision to make. And at the end of the day, you can kind of course correct and reunite the child with the family. It is not great. No one would ever describe that as necessarily a great situation to live through, but it's correctable and something that, you know, hopefully has not great impact on the family or the child's life. The opposite, not intervening when you should intervene, it's kind of the worst case scenario I described earlier, where you may result in kind of a, you know, a fatality or even a severe injury, for which you may not be able to come back from. And so how, you know, that is the worst kind of situation. Being able to understand that spectrum, if you will, of consequences is really what is challenging and not always easy to lay out unless you have a good diverse group of folks to work with to help explore that space.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also, I think that also comes back to the critical thinking piece, which is why we humans are so, so just vital to the process, is because you get a group of smart people working together, we're able to critically think through things that first computers can't do, and second, most people would not spot on their own. Because working in isolation allow, I mean, it tends to reinforce your biases. And I love that you bring up the diverse team perspective, because when you have people with very similar backgrounds working together on the same problem, they're going to end up have they're going to have the same blind spots, and they're going to reinforce those, within each other, which is going to, and I read a book last summer, called Range by David Epstein. It's a fascinating book, and he at one he has subtitle is Why Generalists Triumph in a Highly Specialized World. And he gave at one point he spoke about this gentleman who was he well this is in the 70s, I think, was embedded in research laboratories, like 10 or 15 of the top research laboratories in the country. Yeah, the ones that are making breakthroughs, probably ones that you work at, Chris. And he was trying to figure out why some labs were more productive than others. Why were they able to produce more? And interestingly, the ones that were more productive were ones that had people that were doing diverse research in different topics in different areas at the same spot and held meetings where, you could come in and present your problem that you're grappling with to folks that you are working with, right? That have different backgrounds, that are doing different kind of work, but are also fairly smart and can critically think through things. And it was really interesting. So we actually this gentleman spoke about one specific time where there were two labs that he was embedded with, right? And he had NDA, so he couldn't say anything, that were grappling with the same problem. And the one with the diverse skill sets on site solved the problem 6 months before the other one did. And he's now sitting in staff meetings, listening to them, trying to solve a problem that he knows the solution to, because the folks that were trying, the other people were all physicists, and they thought about the thing, they thought about the problem the exact same way.
No, I think, I mean, what you're describing is, I think, a traditional problem for almost any company, if you will, regardless of kind of industry or discipline. One of the things that I've always kind of emphasized in the groups that I've managed is it's great having that one individual who is just brilliant. And realistically, you can have two or three of them that are brilliant, but it's not necessarily hiring the one brilliant individual that you need to be concerned about. It's about building the right team together, right? And fostering not just that intelligence that everyone brings, but being able to bring together that and emphasize that collaboration nature, right? So I think we talked earlier about just being able to bounce ideas off other people, right? Because you may just see something completely different from me. That doesn't even mean that you're right and I'm wrong. We can both be right from different perspectives, but it's being able to just bring those perspectives to a single decision space that is often really hard, and it, not always easy to do, but is, I think, one of those critical aspects that, any data science project really needs to consider. It's not just the data scientist that is impactful to the success of a machine learning model. It's their
Absolutely.
stakeholders, it's the decision makers, it's even the people who provide the data themselves, are ultimately all a piece of the pie.
Absolutely. And so as you think about just AI and risks of AI within the general public, why do you think it's so hard to communicate the risks of AI to folks, just to the general public?
I mean, I think this is, it's really a hard problem space, right? So it's a very scientific topic. When you think about how an LLM works or how any machine learning model works, is actually pretty difficult that even those who may have a background in computer science or mathematics may still struggle to understand. Being able to just find a common language with the general public, I think, is something that is a challenging nature. But being able to kind of make sure you find it somewhat relatable to them, understanding kind of, well, this is what, this is what used to happen. This is how AI kind of operates and works now too. It's not necessarily replacing people or replicating people, but being kind of an assistive tool to being able to help people make decisions. It can be really tough because I think when you talk about the general public, I think about the aspect of kind of risk management. We all manage risks in our daily lives when it comes to making decisions for our family, for ourselves, or for our job. And everyone can be slightly more risk-seeking, as in they're willing to kind of, go spend $20 on that scratch ticket in the event they may win $1 million. Other people will say, well, no, I'm going to invest that 20, that $20 into my bank account because I know someday it may make me $1 million. Either way, It's just the difference in perspectives, the backgrounds everyone brings. It's all very different. So being able to find a common ground on a particular topic to explain it to folks, it becomes kind of really challenging. And for me, it's being able to find that common ground amongst the different types of people that you might be talking to make sure that they understand, here's what it is, here's what we're using it for, here are the checks and balances we have in place on it to make sure it's not going to go, off the rails or to do anything that is truly harmful to you. And keep us honest, right? Make it engaging. Try to make sure the general public understands where they can play a role in keeping me honest, keeping us honest in terms of how a model is being used, when it's still performing appropriately, and making sure we're aware of all the potential harm that it is so that we can do our best to avoid it.
Absolutely. No, I appreciate that. And last question I have for you, Chris. Have you seen a case where an AI system produced a surprising but not necessarily harmful, just like an unexpected, surprising result? And what did you learn from that?
I think one of the things that I alluded to earlier in our conversation is as a data scientist, I started out my career in saying, hey, all data, I need as much data as you can give me. Give me all the data you can because I never have enough. And more data I can throw into a machine learning model just means that the machine learning model is going to be better, right? Well, not always. And so one of the things that I learned earlier on is that it is helpful to understand kind of what data is available, to have a hypothesis of why that data could be useful, but to go back and to prove why it may or may not be useful. I think every data scientist has gone through at least one exercise, whether it be in college or in their career, of overfitting a machine learning model and understanding, well, that is not actually a good thing for a number of reasons. And so, how can you take a step back and say, okay, I'm going to actually take out this data stream. It's actually expensive for me to collect. It's not providing that much value to the model itself. I am willing to kind of sacrifice maybe a point in accuracy to be able to reduce costs somewhere else and really be able to, kind of make an equivalent decision at the end of the day. So for me, it was just a really surprising kind of like perspective to learn because in college it was here's your data, you can use everything. The real world doesn't work like that, especially if you start to consider kind of the potential harm or expense in being able to collect data that people may not want to provide you. Don't know about your personal situation, but I like to keep my medical history private between me and my doctor. I don't want to necessarily go blast it out there. If you tell me it's going to be helpful, I might be willing to share some of it. But not all of it, if it's not all going to be helpful. So let me take a step back and make sure I'm only sharing what is actually useful.
No, and also like medical history, absolutely. Financials, no, it's
Yeah.
just that, right? But also you start thinking about how could it harm you? How could it get tied back to you? How is it anonymized, right? Is all these are just all additional questions, and also I also think we kind of operate under the illusion that privacy is still a thing when it's not really. You know that better than most, Chris, and it's just it's an interesting place to sit. I think the most valuable number that we have is no longer our social security number. It's whatever our marketing number in Google is.
I mean, I do think there is like inherent security and privacy risks behind any sharing of data, ultimately, right? And it kind of plays into that decision space of like, as a user, I get some value out of an AI or machine learning model if I participate in providing my data to it. And knowing you may not be able to take it back necessarily, you may be able to correct it. But at the end of the day, it's a very tricky situation for just trying to build up kind of trust in a machine learning model and how it's using your data in particular, right? You want to get that value out of it for the value you're putting into it, if you will.
Absolutely. Anything else you'd like to say, Chris? Any points I missed?
No, I'll just say, in general, I really appreciate this conversation, Nick. It's a conversation about data quality and machine learning and the consequences around Having a human in the loop to make sure they understand what's going on in terms of, making sure their decisions are based in part on what machine learning model is providing. It's a passion of mine, and making sure that, anytime I get a chance to kind of share that and make sure emphasize that point, I want to make sure folks understand it. So I appreciate you having me on today.
Man, I appreciate you coming on, Chris. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I've learned a lot from you. I've learned a lot in our conversation. Hope everybody else has as well. And thank you for listening to Robots and Red Tape, everybody. I hope you're having a great day.